Today on the podcast, I have Ben Darkminer on Twitter, who is a full-time option seller about to replace his income and maybe quit his job, which we'll talk about today. So for everyone out there who's in that similar scenario of full-time job, trying to get out of it, you know, Ben's a great example of how you can get on that path. So thanks for being on here, Ben.
Yeah, man. Happy to be here. See you a lot on Twitter. So it's fun to finally put a face and a name and a voice to the online presence.
Yeah, man. So like I was saying, let's just kind of dive into 12 months of option selling. Because if you've been doing this for the last 12 months, I know you've passed like your goals. Like, talk about that journey and what it's been like.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll kind of jump into like why I kind of started selling options too. And you could probably relate to this, but we had a child a couple of years ago, and I was doing the 9-to-5 grind, coming home, you know, taking care of the baby. And I'm like, there's got to be like something more. There's got to be like, I don't want to do this for the next 40 years because I'm pretty young. And so I started like getting on YouTube and watching YouTubers and reading Reddit and like going through all the online posts. And I found like options, right? And I've traded options before. Like, I've bought options, I've sold options, and nothing really ever stuck. And then I found like a strategy called the wheel strategy. And I started using that and like get more comfortable, and like I was on Twitter a lot and just learning. And anyways, long story short, I was like, you know what? I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. Like, now I have like a bigger paying job. Like, if I lose this amount of money, like, I don't really care. And so I started trading options, and I've been doing that. I did that for like a year, just on and off, like little options here and there. And then I started scaling into it heavy in the last 12 months. And then kind of like you talked about, like, my goal ultimately with this is like, between dividends and options income, my full goal is to not have to work, right? And I think a lot of people can relate to that in the sense that, like, if you ever were to get fired, or if you ever were to change jobs or lose your job, like, can you pay your bills? You know, obviously we have emergency funds and things like that, but I hate the fact that, like, if at any time, like, my employer decides they wanted to go a different direction, like, I'm hosed, right? And I've got to scramble for another job, and, you know, my family may go without. And so, like, then I started getting heavy into options, and I started, you know, making, you know, $100 a month and $200 a month and $1,000 a month. And so I was like, you know what, like, this is kind of crazy. Like, I'm going to keep doing more research and get better at charting and like get into some Discords and like figure out. And so I hit it like really heavy. And that's when, like, I started like Twitter and stuff like that back in November. And I said, you know what, I'm going to try to do this. Like, by the time I'm 40, like, my goal is to make like $25,000 a month just selling options. And it's like a safer way to do options rather than the buying side. And so, so far in 2023, I've made just over $65,000 selling options. And that is just by selling options, not like capital appreciation on my shares or anything like that. And so, it's like becoming a little bit more real for me now, because it went from like a side thought to a side hustle to now, like, whoa, like, I could almost quit my 9-to-5 and replace my full income, you know? So that's where I'm at now. And, I know we're kind of like in similar situations. So it's pretty cool to see a bunch of people online that are successful as well. But, I feel like this is just the start, and it's crazy to me that everybody's not doing, you know, similar strategies.
Yeah. So how long were you trading before you made your first 100K with selling options?
Yeah. So, I've been trading for 13 years, so I've been in the market for a really long time. Yeah. The day I turned 18, I opened up a 401k, and I've never, I put, you know, whatever 4% or 6% or whatever, ever, every paycheck since the day I was 18. So I've been putting money in the market for a long time. And obviously that helps with selling options, because, you know, you have to have more money. I've really only traded options really heavy for about 2 years, and then like put a lot of money into it in the last 13 months. Like, I sold one of my houses and had some money there. So I was like, all right, well, like, we'll try this out with $50,000 and see how that goes. And then like, I started putting more 9-to-5 income into it. And then what's crazy with options too, is like last month I did, over $15,000 in options. And the crazy part is like, I don't need the money, right? Like, I have a 9-to-5 and other income as well. So like, I just reinvest it all. And so every month, like, you know, if you're making $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 and you're just reinvesting it, then the next month you have even more capital to make even more money. I mean, you can lose money too, right? But like, that's the crazy part about it. Like, they talk about the dividend snowball, but like the option snowball is a whole nother thing. It really is. Like, it allows you to compound your money like crazy.
Yeah, I think the funds are proving that these option selling funds, like the ones I think you've been posting, do you keep your money in cash when you make it, or do you put it in SPY, or do you put it in dividend stocks? Like, or do you?
I kind of do a little bit of both, right? Like, I obviously like love. So I have like a dividend YouTube channel, and that's, I did that with my wife, and that's purely just dividends, right? And so like I reinvest all those, I buy dividend funds, and that's all from my 9-to-5 income. And then like in my main brokerage account, for the most part, like I'm just accumulating QQQ, Apple, Amazon, Tesla. Tesla's like the biggest one that I accumulate. And I have a little bit of like JETB and JETQ as well. But like for the most part, like I just accumulate probably 30% dividends, and then the rest I just throw back into options, because that's the, for me, that's the most, I can leverage my cash the most doing that.
Yeah, that's a great plan. So cash goes into stock, and then portion of your portfolio is for option selling.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And then I see some people like on Twitter, similar boat as you, like ARK stocks, growth stocks, they're the most attractive to sell options on. But I don't know if you were in the last 24 months selling options, but I got wrecked selling them on, you know, Zoom and ARK and TQQQ. So how do you feel, how do you balance that risk of, you know, growth could go down 70% at any time, you know?
And I definitely learned in the last market, and that's when I was like learning with small amounts of capital. Like I had a bunch of money in TQQQ, and we saw that go from like 70 to like 15 or 16 or something like that. But for me, like I never sold my shares, so I don't care. So it's like, what does it matter if it goes from 70 to 13 when long term I believe in QQQ, right? And so even though it's a triple leverage fund at QQQ, it's the NASDAQ 100. There's obviously, there's a little bit of decay in there as well because it's a leverage fund. But for me, like I just sold calls all the way down, and Tesla was the one that hurt me the most. And I don't know if you saw, like I posted like one of my brokerage's account, I'm up like 70% over the year or something like that, but you can see like a huge dip in it. And that dip was owning TQQQ and owning Tesla, because Tesla went from like 400 down to 100. Right. Yeah. And I just held the shares. But on the flip side, like, although the account was getting obliterated, that doesn't change my option income and it doesn't change my strategy, right? The only thing that I adjusted is where I'm selling calls, rather than selling calls, which I'm selling now at like a 0.1 delta or 0.05 delta, because the stock market has been going up. I was selling at a 0.3 delta, and then it was instant, you know, I'd go to 90% profitability in 2 days. And so like it helped a lot with Tesla, because as we're falling down, I was able to have a little bit of downside hedge, right? Like I'd sell an option and collect $400 of premium on 100 shares. And then 2 days later, I'd close it out for a dollar. And then I'd do it again and again and again. So on the flip side, it's, you know, it's terrible that my portfolio is going down. But for me, like I'm so young, like I really don't care. I'll buy Tesla for 300, I'll buy Tesla for 180, and I'll buy Tesla for 500. I really don't care, because I think in a 10, 15 year time span, it's going to be a good investment, right?
Yeah, I think the problem that I'm curious if you solved is like going down, you don't know the bottom's in, you don't know if it's going to continue to go down. So at any moment, if you put on a covered call, you could have lost your shares. So how did you know to flip from 0.3 delta to a 0.1? Like, because even if you made like, let's say, you know, $3,000 with covered calls, if Tesla doubled, your $26,000 would be, you know, $26,000 more. So
yeah,
$3,000 is like nothing compared to what Tesla did the last 2 months, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and obviously you can't time the market perfectly. The one thing for me is like, I mean, you never know the bottom. And so, but I always traded within that 0.1 to 0.3 delta range. And that helped me stay like where I'm not getting overly aggressive or overly like under aggressive. Right. For me, like I have a thing called the odd lot strategy. I don't know if you're familiar with the odd lot strategy. And so what the odd lot strategy is, and I use this with all of the things that I sell covered calls on, is if I have 100 shares, I have to have an odd lot above that. And that odd lot's full purpose is to be able to run free and clear. In the event that I get caught deep in the money, then I sell those odd lots at a profit and I pay back the cost to close the call so I can get out of the money instantly. And so
I'm sorry. I have no clue what word you just said. What?
Odd lot.
Odd lot?
Lot. Yes.
Okay. So what's an odd lot?
If you own 100 shares, then you say you buy 5 shares on top of that. So now you own 105 shares. So I can sell covered calls on my 100 shares. And then I have 5 shares that are just sitting there. They don't have covered calls. They can't have covered calls. And they're free to run, right? So in the event that the stock runs up and I get caught in the money, you have 2 options, really. You can roll the option out and up, right? And try to get a credit for it. Or if you're caught really deep in the money, in the example you're talking about where Tesla skyrockets, you know, it goes from 100 to 115 or 120 in 1 week. You can sell 2 or 3 shares so that you're protecting your cash that week. And you sell them obviously for a profit because it ran. And you use that to pay down the cost to close that call. And then you reopen one at a much higher strike price. And so that saved me, and because there was multiple instances. And I actually rolled 300 shares of Tesla for 3 months. Three full months. But like, and people are like, oh, see, man, like you're going to lose. Like, but here's the thing. Like, if you're just a buy and hold investor, right? You're just buying and holding, and you're not doing anything. You're not collecting any money on it. You're just letting the stock do whatever the stock does, right? And so rolling, it took me 15 seconds a week, and I just rolled up and out each and every single week. And I was in the money, deep, deep in the money. And I rolled up and out every single week for 3 months. And then eventually Tesla pulled back down off of its rocket ship. And then I was out of the money, and then I'm good to go.
That's some really awesome like tactics that I've literally never heard of. Odd lot
strategy.
Paying for your loss. So you roll it and you don't, you know, you mitigate that. That's beautiful, man. Because we were dropping for like 8 months. You didn't know where the bottom was, but you wanted to protect your capital by covered calls, but you always pay the piper with a covered call, especially on a Tesla, if it rips, because when it rips, your covered calls are destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that is a cool way to get around it. But like if you think Tesla is going to like 600 in the next 3 months, does that change how you put on a covered call, or is there a place where you don't put on covered calls? Like if you're just very bullish.
Yeah. So, I mean, I pretty much am always covered, just for the fact that like, I just like, for the most part, I've always been able to get out of everything, and there may be a day where I can't, but I mean, the stock just went from, you know, 100 to 300 in 6 months. So if I can get out of that, like, I feel like that's not going to continue to happen, but I could be wrong. The market may teach me a lesson. I don't know. But yeah, so like my odd lots, obviously those are uncovered, and you know, I think on Tesla I have like 70 odd lots that just sit, and the rest of them I keep covered. But I don't know if you watch any of the trades I post, but I'm trading like between like a 0.5 and a 0.1 delta, and so I'm collecting very, very minimal premium. So like when we went into earnings last week, you know, Tesla was like, what, 280, 290. I traded a 320 call. So like the stock has to rip through the moon. I mean, we're talking like a $20 move, $30 move. And if it does do that, like I'm in a good position to roll it. Yeah. I make a ton. So it's like I sell a covered call, I make $100, and I allow the stock to appreciate, you know, like $25 to $3,000 in a week. So, you know, that's how I'm trading Tesla right now. I do have some, I also have like a wheel strategy on Tesla too. So I have some positions that I'm long on. And then I also have some positions where I'm getting in and out constantly, right? So like I was assigned a 265 and then I sold a 272.5, right? Like, and I'm fine with that because if I lose those shares, I still collect the 750 premium plus, you know, $400 in premium. Yeah. So I'll book $1,000 in a 2 week trade. And nice. I do that with a portion of my Tesla where I'm getting in, out, and I'm just wheeling the stock, which you're probably familiar with wheel strategy. So yeah. I have some lots where I wheel, and then I have some stocks where I'm like long and I only trade like really, really low deltas.
That's amazing. Yeah, you're really educated. Did you have a mentor or did you just YouTube all this stuff?
So I just YouTube and I read a lot of, I read some books and honestly, I just read a lot of forums and like, I don't know. I just like grabbed info from everywhere I could. I've never had any mentors, but I mean, I do teach options, I guess, but
yeah,
that's about it.
You're the mentor now, but yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how good it is, but
what's your top books and top resources that you'd recommend other than you?
Yeah. I mean, like, there's so many books and they're not necessarily on options, but just like how to like utilize your money and like make your capital work for you and like taking risks. Like I obviously like some, like Robert Kiyosaki's like a really, I don't know, like some people love him, some people hate him. Like if you've read Rich Dad Poor Dad, like, that was like a really good book for me. Just like understanding the way like people interpret money and think about money and like the psychology of money was a good book too. But yeah, like for the most part, like I just scavenge the internet for like ideas and Twitter, there's like a lot of good ideas and a lot of people are really open about like trades that they're making and like the philosophies behind it. And people, like if you ask questions, they'll answer it. And so I kind of just like took a synopsis of like a bunch of different things, YouTube content, Twitter content, Reddit content, like online books. And I just kind of mashed it all up into like what I like to do. And also like I probably trade a little bit differently than some people in some senses and others in other senses, just because like where my age is and where my income is, like I'm a little more risk averse in some things and then like not in other things. And so,
yeah,
it's like kind of like a weird strategy I have going, but, so far, I mean, it's working for me and hopefully it'll continue to work for me going forward.
I love it. Yeah. So with the, question was basically with your option selling, how do you control risk with the right stock? Because if you did like a SoFi or like an AMC or GME, like you got hooked on the wrong one, you could never make back your money. It might take like 10 years to make back a GME, $300 purchase price that you've been wheeling,
No, 100%. And like, I definitely like trade on the riskier side, but like I have some like core stocks that I just don't touch. And I think that's helped like balance out the account in the sense that like, like I have like six figures in QQQ and I trade really safe options on that as well. And so like, I think that gives me a good balance in the account between QQQ and FXAIX. I have the S&P 500 and I have the NASDAQ 100. And, so like, no matter what, like, even if I like blew something up, like I have like really good, like foundational stocks. And then like, for me, for the most part, like I really only trade stocks that I believe in the company's long-term. I do play a little bit of like meme stuff with AMC, but like when you think of like my account size, like when I'm trading, $8,000 on AMC, even if I lost all 8,000, like that's a couple weeks of trading for me. So
yeah.
And like, to be fair, like with the AMC thing, like, people are still going to the movies. Like they still have products. They still have popcorn in stores. Like, even though it's like such a meme stock, like it's still a threat. It's still a company that like is in business and has stuff going for it. And so like, yeah, I mean, it's the risk for me is like, I trade some like higher volatility assets, with just like maybe, 10 to 20% of my portfolio. And then the rest of it's in like higher quality, Apple, Amazon, Google, AMD, QQQ, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So you have a figure, like you don't go over on like an AMC trade, right?
Yeah. So like for me, like I'll trade up to like $10,000 on AMC. And the reason why I'll trade that is because I've been trading AMC for 4 years now. And, I own zero shares of AMC. I just sell cash to care puts and I sell pretty safe cash to care puts. Like right now I have like 30 at the, like the, or I have 20, I think I have 20 or 25 at the 3.5, right? And so like AMC is trading at like $5 right now. So like it would like have to crater to get there. And so I trade pretty safe on that. And then like some of the other things, like I'm a crypto miner. And so like, I like to do like more of like Bitcoin plays with like Mara and Riot. And those are some small cap plays I play as well. And I usually try to trade like between 10, 20% of those just because I'm such a believer in crypto and I have heavily invested in a lot of crypto mining equipment. And so I like to support companies that support the blockchain as well. And so I do trade some high risk there, but yeah, for the most part, all like really, name household names like Apple, Amazon, you know, things that people are using and I'm using, my family using each and every single day.
I like that. Yeah, that's super smart. And Tesla's like a meme stock meets a, you know, safe name, like household name stock. So it's the best of everything and probably the best to wheel because of that.
Yeah, it is a crazy wheel stock. But and also like I have a Tesla, my parents have a Tesla, like all my uncles have Tesla, like everybody in my family has Teslas. And so like I also have like a different perspective. I obviously own the stock, but like I've had a Tesla for 3.5 years and like the product is phenomenal. The technology is phenomenal. The AI in the car, the constant updates, right? How cheap it is to charge every month and like no brakes, like no oil changes. Like there, it is a really great car. And so like I'm bullish on Tesla long-term for a lot of different reasons. And maybe, you know, maybe that will bite me someday, but like, I really love the car. I love the product and I love the company, even though, you know, Elon Musk is kind of like a loose cannon, but whatever.
He's a visionary. He's a, you know, he's breaking ground in everything. So I think if you bet on Tesla, you're just really betting on this guy that has a proven track record of just disrupting industries, energy, cars, solar, like, he's crushing it. And now like Starlink. So going back to the questions, I'm curious with the crypto mining. I was mining like when it was hot and, you know, Ethereum was 3000. Are you mining Ethereum now? Or are you mining Bitcoin?
Yeah. You can't mine Ethereum anymore. They switch over to proof of stake. So you can't even mine it if you wanted to. You could mine Ethereum Classic, but for me right now, I have like a couple S19s and those just mine Bitcoin. And then I have some rigs that are mining Caspa as well. And then for the most part, like you see on GPU on the desk, like I have a lot of sitting rigs right now. Because I have an LLC for it, it's a little bit different. But yeah, I definitely got into it like when it was hot and each card was making like $5 a day. And it lured me in. So my brother and I, you know, we started a company and we just like, we seriously bought a GPU like every single week for like a year, but we kind of did it differently in the sense that like we put some initial capital into it. And then what we would do is we cash out 85% of our mining profits every single week and we buy another card with the profits. And so like, you know, I have like over $100,000 worth of equipment now, but almost all of it's paid for by profits. So it's not like very, like for them sitting in my basement right now, like it's not very risky. In that sense, but yeah, like I'm not mining a whole lot now, but I do believe in it long term. We've had these crypto cycles and you're probably aware of this, you know, for the last 13 years, and the Bitcoin halving is coming up in, I think it's in next April, and I think that it'll come back, maybe not in, you know, in such steam that it did before because we don't have Ethereum, but I do think there's some really good proof of work coins that have proved themselves and will continue to prove themselves. And I think profitability will come back. It's right there next to break even if you have, you know, that 10 cent power, 11 cent power. So yeah, I really hope in the next year it comes back. My plan will be to, you know, turn the whole farm back on. If not, you know, hopefully like last run, you know, 3070s went from, you know, $40 to $1,200 or $400 to $1,200. And so I also have like the hardware play where I could sell all my gear for, you know, 2-3x what I bought it for. So that's my hope. It could completely blow up in my face, but like I said, I bought almost all of it with profits throughout the run. And so my risk is very low, capital actually out of my bank account.
Yeah, that's super smart too, how you've managed that play, because like growing that business, that's like one of the best ways to do it. Just buy that, buy the rigs and the cards with the profits. But you know, at the peak, I'm surprised you. I wonder what your rig was collection is worth at the peak, because I was paying $2,000 maybe for a 3090, and I think I might have sold them for $1,000 each at the end of it all. I don't know.
But did you cash out on everything?
Yeah, I think I put $60,000 in, and I might have lost. I might have lost 10, and it was just a waste of time. But
yeah.
I congratulate anybody who got in earlier, because that was the time where you could have scaled. I missed scale.
I definitely did too. And like I definitely played scalper prices on some stuff, but I also like with like Best Buy, I don't know if you remember that, like they had like drops at stores and like, yeah, I'd sleep overnight with a bunch of friends. Yeah. And we'd come back with like six Founders cards, you know? And so like, I could have turned around and sold them for double, but for me, like a 3070 was making like, you know, between like $5 and $7 a day. And so my farm was, my farm after cost was making, you know, like between like $150 and $200 a day. And so it's like,
yeah,
I mean, we were all in the same, like, oh, this is freaking awesome. This is going to last forever. And then, and then it didn't. Right. And now I got a bunch of sitting hardware, but yeah, I know some part of me wishes maybe I would have sold some. And then I also like held a lot of coin too. And like hindsight's 2020, but like, I wish I would have just cashed out on a bunch of my Ethereum rather than like, I staked some with Coinbase, you know, just like weird things like that.
Yeah.
And you know, like woulda, shoulda, coulda, right? Like you just never know. But I do truly believe that, you know, in the next 2 years, we'll get back to some profitable mining, and hopefully that's my exit there. It is a lot more than I thought it would be. It was one thing to have like one card or 10 cards, but like when I started getting into ASICs and hundreds of cards, like the heat management and like,
yeah,
I've got like ducting under my house with like seven exhaust fans, and I've got like a heat room and like racks. It's just like, yeah, it's kind of insane. A little too much.
I had to pay like $6,000 to rewire my electrical in my garage. Yeah. So at the end of the day, I think that the winner was the person that's, you know, selling the pickaxes to go mine gold. Like the dude that sold me the rig, he doubled his money. He put in 10 to 15K. I paid 30. He made 250 to 500K in this whole cycle, and he's liquid. He put that in back into Ethereum, and like that tripled. So he almost steamrolled it with. So I think the real opportunity was those dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. They timed it right.
Because I think the time you waste with this stuff is so valuable. If you're like busy, like you got a family, like my house was like 1,000 degrees. Like it wasn't fun.
Dude, there was a point where like I have a new house now, but like I had a much smaller house, and I had like 40 rigs behind me in a grow tent, and it was like ducting out the side, and I'm like in meetings, and it was like a lot. It was like I was in a data center, man. My wife's like, this is crazy, man. Like, what are you doing? But like, yeah, now that like I sell options and trade stocks, like it's just hard to like, I mean, I love crypto mining, and obviously like I'm going to continue to do it, but like when you talk about like the time commitment and like the amount of energy I had to spend, like updating my rigs every, you know, 5 seconds and part failures and stuff like that. I'm just like, if I could go back in time, I probably never would have scaled as much as I did, you know, kept it more like a hobby, maybe like 20, 30 cards, but yeah, it gets a little too crazy. I think we both learned that lesson.
Yeah. A lot of lessons learned when there's a lot of fear, FOMO, greed, like you get sucked into things you wouldn't normally do, you know, in a rational times. But yeah, I mean, it was when you make enough money, like you start valuing your time. And like, if you were making any substantial money, I'm sure you wouldn't have scaled that business. Like if you were making double what you were making that time. So
yeah.
The house is beautiful though. You have a beautiful house.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. No, I mean, you're 100% right. Like the more money you make, and like, obviously the bigger your family gets too, time becomes a lot more valuable. And when my brother and I started it, you know, we were like younger and he was in med school, and we were like, yeah, like this is great income for us. You know, like we were stoked about making like $50 a day doing nothing, $100 a day doing nothing. But now it's like, I you know, today I made $100 in like 3 seconds selling one option, you know. So it's like,
yeah.
So it's just a little different, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I want to dive into just the athletics, because I don't think I'm ever going to talk to a high end athlete that's also an option seller. I mean, that's got to be like a unicorn here. So
yeah.
Tell me the past, dude. College.
Yeah, high definitely. School, yeah. I think that's where like we like first bonded online too. I think you posted a picture of you running or something like that. I'm like, no way. Like somebody else runs. And so, yeah, like kind of like a weird, like unique thing. Like, but when I was like younger in high school, I raced dirt bikes like pretty competitively. And my parents were like, And I don't know why my parents were like, look, like, we'll support you in racing dirt bikes, but you have to do a sport. Like, you have no choice. Like, you need to do sports in high school. And like, obviously parents like know, like, you know, you have friends and you learn a bunch of stuff and whatever. Anyway, so I was like, all right, well, what's like the easiest sport that I can do that I like have to spend the least amount of time doing? I'm like, running is a good one. Like, it's just me. I don't like, there's a team aspect to it, but for the most part, like, it's just you. And so I'm like, this will make me, you know, a good shape for riding dirt bikes. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to do this. And then I started running in like, I think it was like my junior year or something like that. And I'm like, oh, I kind of like this. Like, this is kind of fun. And then like, I started, you know, like winning some races and like setting PRs. And I'm like, well, this is kind of like cool. And then like, long story short, I moved to Utah. And when I was coming here, like, I was looking at two potential schools and they were like looking up my times. And then they like started like trying to like recruit me or whatever. Like, yeah, I come here. Like, we have like good connections to this college and this college. And I'm like, all right, well, so I picked like a school called Davis High. And, yeah, like I started running and then I started like getting better and better times. And then I started like, you know, like getting into like the top 10 of the school record. And I was like, well, like, do you think I can like go to school and do something like this? And my coach was like, yeah, he's like, I think you can get a scholarship doing this. Like, if you keep like busting your butt and working hard. And so then I like stopped racing dirt bikes because it's too dangerous.
Yeah.
And then I started having some like colleges scout me and like recruit visits. And anyways, long story short, I got a full ride scholarship to two different schools. And I picked one of the schools and I started running out there. And college running is way different from high school running. And I can't remember if you ran, we'll talk about you in just a second, but like, I high school was so fun. Like, you're like hanging out with like a bunch of cool girls and like, you have like a group of friends and like, you're just like running around, like being an idiot. And then like, you get into college and it's like, okay, you can't do anything outside of this. You're training for 3 hours a day. You're going to the gym, you're eating certain things, like you're throwing up after every practice. And then like, you start like pushing your body like to the max every single day. And you're like, this is absolutely insane. Right. And then I started like getting some like knee pains and I had to like, get, like I had to do like some surgery and stuff like that. But anyway, so like long story short, yeah, like I love running. It's like one of my favorite things ever. And I just brutally beat my knees up to the point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. And that's my whole running. That's my whole running spiel. I don't know if I've ever even told anybody about that.
No, I appreciate you letting me be the first.
I want to hear your journey, man.
Does the wife not even know?
No, she knows that. Yeah. She knows.
So I guess like, what was your why? Because like, if you couldn't, if your why wasn't strong enough post-surgery, I was just curious, like in college, like what kept you going and what your why was.
Yeah. So like my why for running is like, I like honestly just loved running and I love the adrenaline behind it. There's just like, they talk about adrenaline highs. When you get off of like a workout and like when you're an athlete your whole life, like you kind of just get used to that. And so like when you're competing at like, I wouldn't say like the highest level, but when you're competing at like some of the highest levels in sports, or for running, like you just get used to it and you love it and you have like a hunger for it. And like, I truly loved running, like, and I still do to this day, but I love like being competitive. And I loved that, like, it's just me versus the tarmac or, you know, or like the course, yeah. Like depending on if I'm running cross country or not. But yeah, like I loved it. It was just like you versus that and you just get in your own head and like, there's a mental battle and a mental strongness behind it. And like, and then you have like so much support staff once you get into college too. And like, that was really cool. But yeah, like, I mean,
did you have any like bucket list goals you were chasing throughout your career that kind of were like the carrot?
I mean, yeah, like, I mean, when I was like, when I first like got into it, I was like, oh, I want to go like sub 5 minute mile, sub 4 minute or sub 4.5 minute mile, you know, sub 4:30 mile. And like, it just kept going. I kept bringing it down. And then like, also like for the 800, like, I was like, all right, I want to go like a sub 2 minute and then a sub 1:55. And like, so I started checking those things off and like, there was a lot of satisfaction in that. And then like you set, you know, there's, everything's time written. So like you set a lot of goals for that. You set goals for like how many miles you want to put in per week. And like, you want to like resting heart rates when you wake up to be a certain, like, so it's like, there's a lot of like, weird goals that you set for yourself that like nobody can relate to. And so that was pretty cool. But yeah, like for me, like I loved running, and I loved like the team aspect of it. And I loved like kind of like how I am with like Discord and stuff now. Like I love just like being with people that like shared like a common, like we all loved running. Like we were all there because we loved running, right? Like nobody gets into running because they have to. Well, I guess I kind of did, but like nobody like sticks with running or goes into college for running, like unless they love running, you know what I mean? Like, and it's like such a weird thing to run, like to love, because a lot of people can't relate to loving running because it's usually like something people do to like lose weight or get in shape or whatever. But like, yeah. I loved it and I still do. It's just a fantastic sport. So
it's a drug, man. It's 100% drug, that like high end workout, like high end race for sure.
Yeah.
But to your point though, I am curious because like my third year in college, we did DMR for people running like different distances. And I think we hit eighth, so all American.
Oh my gosh.
It's D3, so not as impressive as you, but I just remember like being in that group and thinking like there's nothing that's ever gonna feel like this. And it's true. Yeah. And it's so depressing because you'll never get that camaraderie, that like everybody just suffering for one goal. Like even in the Discord, it's like, I don't know. I'm not
It's definitely different than that.
Yeah. I mean, have you felt anything as incredible as like that team atmosphere and that bonding from goal setting?
Especially with like relays too, like we had called the medley, which is probably like the DMR. We had the 4, the 8, the mile.
Yeah.
So like we set the school record on that. That's where I actually started picking up like recruits. But that like once we like the high you get from that, and the camaraderie like you were speaking of, like there's just nothing like, the only thing that I can ever relate to would be like having a child and like the love that you have for that child for no reason right off the bat. And you just, every parent can like relate to that. It's similar to that kind of thing. Like you just, it's a different kind of love, a different kind of passion. And just like, I don't know. It's just, it's so hard to explain, you know?
No. Yeah.
So you ran in high school and then did you voluntarily run in college? Did you pick up a scholarship? Like how did you transition from high school to college?
Yeah. I'm kind of like probably delayed on your timeline. Like you were excited in high school and then college kind of like drained your mental energies. I was like, had no clue what I was doing in high school. Just like hopped into college thinking like I should just, you know, continue this.
Yeah.
In college, I found my passion. I kind of swung the passion upswing and went professional after that and ran professional in Colorado for 5 years. You know, Colorado, like Olympians are left and right on your shoulder, just like in workouts and in the long runs. So I've seen it all. I think kind of like the circular moment was I was like in high school. I didn't know who Prefontaine was. Everybody's like, Prefontaine, like, he's so cool. And so I'm like, okay, I'll watch track. So I sat down, I watched the Olympics. I saw Leo Manzano get a silver medal and knew that guy, like followed him, like he was the man. And then like 8 years later, I lined up next to him and I almost kicked him down.
No way.
Yeah.
That's insane.
That's my claim to fame. But I beat Nick Willis out of a different heat. I raced Leo Manzano in the same heat. It was fun, but it was the hardest thing ever was to go from college to pro because life got tough and like injuries amounted and the grind got tougher. Like you worked harder. It was like redlining every day for nothing because no one's paying you. So
yeah. So when you go pro, right? So obviously you get out of high school, you know, you lose all the gear and stuff. When you go pro, like, is your goal to try to pick up sponsors for like shoes and, you know, like local shops and like stuff like that? Is that what you're going for? Or are you like trying to go for the Olympics? Like that's your full goal?
I think going pro for my definition was going to the Olympic trials, which was to run like 338, 339. And I was the peak of my career, like 343. But then I was like 10 times better than that and COVID happened. So I'll just never know what I could have done. And it's super shitty, but my goal is always run sub four, and 3:43 is like literally sub four, like to the 10th of a time.
Yeah.
Or
oh yeah.
100th. So
dude, that's insane.
Yeah. I hung it up with reaching my goal, but that last year I was like running insane times, like 152 at altitude in the 800. Like it was, wow. it was going to be a huge year, but there's no races with COVID, and
yeah,
I just was basically training by myself with no races in mind and hoping someone's going to open up a track somewhere. And
yeah, dude, yeah, that's insane. A 152, because like my fastest time is a 151.8 in the 800, and I did it at like 4200 altitude, and like that you want to die after you finish that race. Like your heart is pounding through your chest. Like everything is like hot. I don't even know what your kick looked like, but you must have just been flying to hit that time. Cause I did it once and then I never could get under 153 again.
Yeah. I did it at Air Force, which is 8,000 feet.
Oh my gosh. 8,000. Yeah. So at sea level, you probably would have cracked under 150.
Yeah. I think it's a second. I would give myself a second. I'd maybe 150, 155. But yeah, I think the, what I found through the journey was like anybody who's like a astronaut, you know, sub four milers are as rare as astronauts. Anyone who's an Olympic athlete, like it's very depressing after that. Like yeah. Life is never the same. So yeah, it's been like
you can't get that high ever again.
Yeah. You just don't feel like the passion and like that. Like your life, you were meant to do something. Like if you had, people don't wake up and feel that, you know, like astronauts, like it feels like that's your life purpose when you're eating breakfast, when you're going to sleep, when you're drinking water, like you have your life purpose in the back of your mind. But like I make YouTube videos, it doesn't feel like that anymore, but
yeah,
it still feels good, but nothing's ever going to be what an athlete's life felt like, which is. It's tough, honestly.
So are you doing any training now? Like, do you do any local races or Ironmans or anything like that?
No, I would never want to race again. It makes me sick to think about training at a high level again.
It's kind of like a funny story. Cause like I haven't done any like local races besides like some little like 5Ks that I went like at my mom's pace with her and stuff. But my brother-in-law did the Ironman in St. George's last year, and he's like, dude, you gotta do it with me next year. And I'm like, anyway, so we signed up for the Ironman. It's like a half Ironman or whatever. Yeah. So it's only like 70 and some change. But yeah, how am I supposed to train for that? Cause it's like, do I train for it like as a dad, or like, do I like try to like really get at it again? You know, like,
yeah,
a little Ironman's a little different. Like for anybody that's not familiar with Ironman's, like you're running, you're biking, and you're swimming. So it's like, you have to kind of be good at all those things, or I guess really good at one of them and okay at the other two. But yeah, it's going to be interesting, like trying to train for that. Cause
when is it?
It's going to be next May. You should come do it with me.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I probably won't turn the burners on. Cause we're going to have a new baby. So I'm probably not going to turn the burners on until like December. And then like I'll train hard for like 4 or 5 months and try to get in shape for it. But at a dad level, not like level, because like, but yeah, like it's kind of like weird to think about training again, because like once you train like at that high level, it's just like it's just so different. Like they have programs for you, and you have coaches for you, and you have like all kinds of assistants, and like it's just different. So it'll definitely be different this go around.
Yeah, it's definitely like goals, but like it's more just like chasing like a slight passion and just doing something because you want to, you know, it's not because like you're trying to change the world, you know,
just for fun. Yeah. I'm not trying to go for the Olympics, which I can't even do that. I can't even, that's crazy. I can't even imagine if I would have got to that level, but I mean, injuries stink, but I don't know if I ever could have pushed it that hard. That's cool that you have that passion going through college. I don't know why, I just couldn't get the focus on and I couldn't get the health right.
Yeah. I think that really is like the difference maker between those who level up consistently and those who, you know, peak and then that's their peak forever, is injuries, honestly. Like not being able to hit that consistency. Yeah. It's all mental. Like everything's mental.
Yeah.
Trading,
well,
options.
Yeah, it's there's so much mental to it, but like there, I mean, with running, like there definitely was physical. Like I was in the physical therapist every day and they're like,
oh, yeah,
they're like massaging my knees. Like they're like clicking every time I'm running. Like my knee was like literally like, you can't do this anymore. So it's like, I mean, like as much as I wanted to keep running, like I literally would have had to get new knees at like 18, you know.
Do you remember the hardest workout you ever ran?
The hardest workout I ever ran, probably we did like a 15 mile Saturday run, and we did it all through the mountains, and we just kept cycling up and down the mountains. So we'd go from like 4,000 to 6,000, 4,000 to 6,000, 4,000 to 6,000. And it was like, I literally thought I was going to die. And like, you have your coaches like riding bikes along, like yelling at you the whole time. And I'm like, dude, you're like on a freaking bike, like quit yelling at me. And like, my heart's like pounding through my chest. I like looking at my heart rate monitor. I'm like, you know, like 160s, 170s. And I'm like, I'm going to die if I do this. And like 50 mile run is like, no joke. Like you're kind of at it for a while, but yeah, that was probably like one of my hardest. And then like some of the other hardest, like when we trained like indoor. And so we ran around like our basketball stadium inside because it's, you know, winter here. Mm-hmm. And so we just did like laps and laps and laps around it. And yeah, like that's probably like some of my hardest, like small workouts, because you're just like sprinting 400s over and over and over and over and over. And it's like,
yeah,
I'm going to die. I think I'm going to die. And you just throw, I think I threw up like three or four times in one workout. I'm like, this is why am I doing this? This is crazy. I'm doing this for like a $15,000 a year freaking scholarship. That's it. But like you said, like you're just addicted to it. I mean, it's just part of your life, and you're addicted. Like you love it. You love all the new shoes and the swag, and you know, like the varsity jackets and the team and all that. I mean, you go on trips every single weekend. Like it's just so, there's just something to it that's just so different, which you know, not a lot of people can relate to.
This is UW, right?
Weber State University.
You're what?
Did you say UW, the school?
You went to UW?
No, I went to Weber State University.
Oh, got it. It's not Weber State?
They call it Weber, whatever. Yeah, Weber.
So you D3 or not?
No, it's D1.
Oh, okay. I remember the jerseys.
Yeah, they're purple. Purple and white.
Yeah, I've seen them at like, we go to Armory and stuff. I think I've seen them at the Armory.
Yeah. So,
all right. So we'll wrap up. Talk about your best race ever. I need to hear it.
Honestly, the best race I ever had was that medley relay. It was at a state championship race, at our home field. And, I mean, as you know, it's the mile, the four, the eight, and the two. And I was the eight, which is the very end of it. And, So like that's my best race I've ever had. The adrenaline was at all time high. The camaraderie was at all time high. I set my PR, jumping down under 152. And, that was like the video that got sent to a bunch of scouts. And that's the one that ended up landing me some full rides. There was just nothing like it. We broke the school record. I don't even know. I'd have to go look and see if we still have it, but like, yeah, it's just like you get through the finish line and like, you have like that group of four people and there's nothing like it. I had a PR and like, I don't know, it was just awesome. That was the best race I've ever had. The best experience I've ever had. And which is crazy is I was in high school. Right. And so like college, even though like college had like some really cool experiences, that was definitely the best one for me. I got to hear yours though, racing and against professionals.
Well, I mean, like you said, like kind of like the markets, you have like that huge day or huge race. And it's like sometimes that's the pinnacle and like, you're almost chasing that the rest of your career.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people that like are millionaires in the market and then lose it all. And it's just like a mental block. Like, oh, I did it once. I can't do it again. Like it was just luck or something, but
yeah.
Timing. Yeah. For me, I think the DMR going All American was camaraderie wise best race, but my favorite race ever was Under the Lights mile at Boulder Stadium. And it was like a bunch of professionals. this dude just graduated Adams State and he was like multi All-American and he was 4 flat or 4.03. And, you know, that was the dude. And I was like, not the favorite, not even thought about. I had a fever like the last 2 days. It was just like, we'll just see what happens. And one lap to go, I'm still in the lead pack. And you know, that 300 meters, like that turn.
Oh yeah. The kick came on.
So the dude that's the best in the field, like he goes to the outside of the pack 300 to go, trying to make the move. And I boxed him in, went first, and he just never got me. And it's pitch black. Like you can't hear anything on the back stretch. In the home stretch, it's just wild. I don't know where this guy is, but just kick him down.
Arms are flailing a little bit.
I think under the lights, you cannot be under the lights. It's like the best racing like atmosphere.
Dude.
But everyone, I know everyone in Boulder. So it was like when I finished, it was like all my friends like at the line. It was a really cool thing.
That's awesome, man. There's nothing like the last 200 too.
Yeah. If you're an 800 guy or a miler, like if you have a kick, like it's so fun just getting in that place with 100 to 200 to go and seeing if you have it.
Yeah. Give it everything you literally have. I remember so many times just falling out to the finish line. Like I literally had nothing left there. That was it.
That's a great feeling too. And
yeah,
it's other side of the coin is like, if you finish and you have extra, it's like, it's the worst feeling in the world.
Yeah. You're like, I have more in the tank. Yeah. That's definitely the worst. And like you said, kind of with like stocks too, like, I mean, like you obviously can't replace that same feeling, but like it is kind of weird. Like as you like continue to level up your accounts, and you've probably seen this as you trade with more and as you have bigger wins, like there's a dopamine hit that you get off of that. Right. And so I remember like my first like $1,000 day, just trading options, and then $2,000 day, and then $3,000 day. And it's like, it's slowly like, obviously like I can, you know, trade like $500 to $1,000 a day now, like every day. And it's like, it's like just another day in the business, but I don't know, man.
The dopamine hits aren't as large because you've done it so much.
Yeah, but yeah, they still are fun, and I do like that. It still makes you like feel alive a little bit.
Exactly. feel like everyone's anti dopamine on the internet, but like everybody gets dopamine somewhere, so it's like. You can't avoid like chasing it, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, every time you send it in a Tesla or go on a roller coaster, or, you know, like there's like so many things that give you dopamine in life. Like in some sense, it's like good for you, right? Like makes you feel alive, which is always good.
Why not feel alive instead of these people that want to almost never feel alive?
Never feel alive. Yeah. I'm glad that we're the same there because, you gotta have something that keeps you ticking every day.
Yeah, I think there's just tweets on the internet that almost get like picked up by AI and recycled. Like I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't watch porn, I don't like, you know, say hi to people and on Wednesdays, like, and everybody just copies this tweet. It's like, just, come on, like,
you
do something fun. Let's be honest.
They just regurgitate the same things. Yeah, it's just like, come on, guys, like, let's do a little here. Come on.
Well, I appreciate you being on here and I definitely want to get into more stuff. So we'll have to have you back on, Ben, but thanks again for letting me sharing some stories and kind of letting people know your option selling journey. And there's way more that you need to hear. So we'll have you back on again.
Okay, man. Sounds good. I appreciate the conversation. Always, always fun talking to a fellow Twitter and runner and happy trading, man.
Yeah, best of luck in the markets.